Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and my guest for this session is the playwright and academic Dan Rebellato, whose latest play is called Chekhov in Hell and is currently running at the Drum Theatre in Plymouth. Dan's other plays include Here's What I Did With My Body One Day, Static and Mile End. He has collaborated with Suspect Culture Theatre Company and has also written several plays for radio. As an academic, he's Professor of Contemporary Theatre at Royal Holloway University of London, and his publications include the seminal 1956 and All That, and more recently, Theatre and Globalisation. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Dan.
Hello.
Could you start by telling us why you wrote Chekhov in Hell?
Well, I can tell you where it started, which is that I was thinking a lot about Chekhov, as you do, because I was working with my students and doing a new version of Three Sisters. I don't know any Russian, but a group of us just tried to create a new version. So I was just trying to think about what Chekhov's distinctive style was. And I've always been quite interested in his sort of satirical gaze, that sense in which he kind of looks in a sort of, I don't know, critical, quizzical, amused way at the world.
And detached, but engaged in that he is thinking actively.
Yeah, exactly. And he's, you know, he's clearly very sympathetic. But what he seems to do, I always think, is he's a bit like Eddie Mayer, the news reader, who's the 5 o'clock news on Radio 4. The thing Eddie Mayer does, which I always find very amusing, is he's really comfortable with silence, and none of his guests are. So his guests will finish what they think they had to say, and he just doesn't butt in. And so they carry on babbling. Actually, I do this when I think there's a silence. I babble and make a fool of myself. And it just feels to me that Chekhov has that kind of relationship with these characters to some extent. He sits back and lets them talk nonsense.
Yeah. It's funny you should say that, because obviously that's quite an English thing,
right?
Filling the silence. And yet it's not a Russian thing. In Russia, it's more accepted just to sit there, you know?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And of course, in a sense, this isn't it's not a literal description of how he writes, because you can't just sit back and let your characters talk as such. But but nonetheless, I think there are those moments in the plays where people very often say idiotic things when they're filling silences, quite often. You know, you can think of characters in Cherry Orchard and the Seagull and so on, who sort of are constantly making comments where, and everyone is kind of, oh, do shut up, that's such a boring story, isn't it? So anyway, I was thinking about that sort of satirical impulse, and I suppose one way of thinking about that was, what would Chekhov's characteristic gaze be on the contemporary? How would he see the contemporary world? And that, I suppose, academic thought quite quickly morphed into thinking of a theatrical structure. So there was that thought going on. And then kind of at the same time, just the title, Chekhov in Hell, popped in my head, and I thought it had a nice little fluttery rhythm to it.
Can we look at the title? Because it's obviously, it's about Chekhov and the contemporary world.
Yeah.
And therefore the contemporary world is hell. It reminded me slightly of Dr. Faustus, Why This Is Hell Nor Am I Out of It. Is that the kind of message, do you think?
Well, actually, I would stick with what I said about those two initial impulses. One is Chekhov writing about the contemporary, and then I had a title, and I was interested in the juxtaposition of those. I think that's as far as I would go. I'm not saying he actually experiences himself as being in, you know, Dante's Inferno, if you see what I mean. Clearly it's an experience he finds quite unsettling, but I'm not saying anything as direct as that.
Okay, he does look as if he's suffering to me, but let's have a plot summary. How would you describe, talk us through. And so in the first scene, what happens?
The first scene is 1904 in the Hotel Sommer in Badenweiler, where Chekhov went to try and effect a cure for his tuberculosis, and where he actually died. And the first scene is Chekhov's death scene, and it is extremely naturalistic, to the extent that it's entirely in Russian and German. And it follows the documented, recorded history of that. So that's the first scene. And the second scene is about 100 years later. He wakes up. He's just woken up from a 100-year coma in a British hospital. He's been introduced to his kind of great-great-great-great-niece. And so he's disturbed to find himself in the contemporary world. He walks out of hospital and learns a bit of English and then goes around contemporary Britain meeting various different people.
And there's something wonderful about him being like sort of lost child, but a kind of harmless individual that people instinctively trust.
Yeah.
Because he finds himself meeting, who is it, Russian mafia.
Yeah.
And people trafficker, and he meets various individuals who open up to him and everything, and it's a kind of nice device to travel through contemporary Britain. Could you talk us through a few of the scenes? Because there's a whole variety of different people he meets.
Yes, absolutely. Well, he, as you say, he everyone thinks he's a great listener. People keep saying, you know, you're very easy to talk to and things like that, which I actually just think is because he shuts up. Yeah. And so what they pure mean is it's a really nice to have an opportunity just to keep talking non-stop without being interrupted. But he does, he meets lots of people. He meets a fashion designer, for example, who talks him through what the next kind of 3 years of fashion are going to be like. He meets a hip-hop star, R&B star, who shows him around her crib in the kind of style of MTV Cribs, I think. He meets a kind of internet guru who's constantly talking about, you know, the way the whole world is changing and Web 2.0 is, you know, has rendered the entire history of humanity redundant and that sort of thing. There's a few of those. Restaurateur he meets kind of feng shui experts who go into offices and tell you how how by changing the arrangement of the desks you can make offices much better places to work in.
And that's what I enjoyed a lot was the survivors group.
Oh, right.
Which is, you know, yes, very comic and everything. But let's return to that first scene. You say it's in Russian and German. Mm-hmm. Do you have surtitles, or is it so obvious what's more or less happening that was unnecessary?
It's funny you should say that. No, there are no surtitles at all. Mm. It's entirely in Russian and German. And actually, it's one of those things. When you write something like this, obviously the idea was you start in this slightly baffling way.
Yeah. But it's got an estrangement device, and it takes you back in history.
It does. And it's also a sort of joke about naturalism as well, you know, that if it were really naturalistic, you wouldn't understand what was going on. And, I mean, you know, visually you can sort of work out what's going on.
Yeah.
But it was quite interesting because you write it something to be baffling, and then actually you sit in the theatre with an actual audience and you think, oh wow, this may actually just be baffling. And it works quite well, I think, because on the first night we had in Plymouth, it was a really nice, really full house, and I guess it must have been about 60% teenagers, I think. And you know the way teenagers kind of brilliantly feel things really intensely. And there was this moment when he starts speaking in Russian, and there were a couple of lines in German, and you could see them all kind of looking at each other in panic, because obviously they're kind of thinking, you know, have we made the worst mistake of our lives? Are we going to have to sit for an hour and a half watching a play that's entirely in languages we don't understand? But of course, you know, I guess you kind of know what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly you can tell that he's died. Yeah. And then they clear the set very quickly, and the first line of the next scene is, "You're having a fucking laugh, ain't ya?" Which kind of breaks that tension and it kind of makes the point about where we've gone.
Yeah, that's a lovely line. You've got a lot of characters and a lot of various scenes. What size cast was there for this production?
There's six for this one, and I think there would have to be a minimum of five, because the survivor scene that you mentioned has got five. In I think the first scene's got five as well, but obviously you could do it with 15.
But with that size cast, there's obviously a lot of doubling. Is it quite fast and furious, because some of the scenes are quite short? And How does it work?
Yeah. Well, I think it's... I mean, for me, it's part of the fun of it, really, that you get... I mean, the actors will... I mean, they don't... There aren't... We don't really do costume changes. They basically have the same... They wear the same stuff for all their characters. Oh, but they'll change... They'll change accents and they'll change physical style, and that becomes, I think, part of what's enjoyable. And there's also, you know, I mean, I think that there's something quite deliberate in that that desire not to have costume in that specific way. I mean, Chekhov, obviously, Chekhov himself is beautifully, beautifully styled and looks. Simon Gregor, who plays Chekhov, you know, there's a kind of a wig, and he has the pince-nez and the perfect suit, and he just, you just think, wow, that is exactly image of Chekhov. Yeah, yeah. Whereas everyone else is sort of, their costuming is much more arbitrary, which is also about trying to create a separation between Chekhov and the world that he finds himself in.
What appealed to me was this, exactly what you're saying, this clash of sensibilities between Anton. You know, he goes up to a young girl in a park, and he's still living in an age where you can go up to children, old men can go up to children and say things to them, and she thinks he's a pervert, and of course then the police arrive and so on. I mean, is that one of the deliberate sort of jokes that runs through the play?
Yeah. Yes, I absolutely. I mean, there's a sort of, I mean, what I kind of hope is that Chekhov's sort of presence in the play creates a kind of estranging effect, whereby you see things that you recognise are normal in our contemporary world. Like, it's in a contemporary world, I wouldn't dream of going up to a girl and talking to her in the park. But Chekhov's presence there, I hope, kind of allows you to think, actually, this is really weird. The kind of things you're saying are just bizarre, and sometimes they're horrifying, and the style in which you're saying this is hard to believe, and so on.
Yeah, there's a terrible moment, actually, in the Fashionista scene, when Max, I think it is, says, women are stupid. I mean, from the point of view of fashion, women are actually stupid, because they will buy... You know, even intelligent, high-flying women. I mean, obviously that's his point, but it's also quite a fierce point to make about society today.
So. And Chekhov's response is, "You believe this," and he can't. He sort of can't get a handle on. Yeah. Are you just saying that to appall me, or are you saying that because you mean it? Because that seems an incredible thing to believe. Well, I mean, that's quite interesting, because Matt, that scene with Max, where the second half of the scene does become his sort of personal theory of fashion, which is basically that men design stupid clothes for women because when you see a woman wearing the stupid clothes you've designed for them, it's a turn on, because it means that a woman is completely dominatable, if that's a word. It's very interesting sitting in the theatre when that scene plays, because there's a part of me, of course, that wants to stand up and announce to people, I don't believe this.
Yes.
But actually, because I met Max, that scene is based on, I was at a kind of dinner party thing, and a fashion designer, he basically did exactly that rant, including the bit about, there's a bit in the play about thongs. He has a theory about what happened with thongs and hipster jeans. And it was the same thing, where I kind of thought I don't know whether he meant what he was saying, but he clearly delighted in the the offence that people took, the effect it had on us, and the looks of horror, and the anger that, you know, the quite inarticulate anger that we all produced. And he loved that effect, that he could just kind of drop this bomb. And of course, the other thing is, in a funny way, it's a perfectly sort of feminist point. A feminist could absolutely agree with what he's saying.
And it's also a point about consumer capitalism and that kind of relationship where the consumer in the end is never fulfilled, although the dreams are so big, but you're always paying too much for what you actually get.
Well, like in the scene with the internet guru, he's designed an app for a kind of iPhone, where you can just sort of scan the room and it tags and shows you the price of everything you're looking at. You know, and I mean, it's very typical of the whole play in the sense that I think, on one level, I think, God, that's brilliant. Mm. Imagine if you could actually do that. And I suspect not that far away
from it's only a matter of time.
But then on the other hand, you think that's the most horrifying way of looking at the world. An app that can just show you the monetary value of everything around. Mm. Cost of everything and the value
of nothing. Yeah, yeah. You've also got a few Chekhovian jokes about Chekhov, understandably, in the play. And the one that I obviously picked up on is, if you introduce a gun, somebody has to fire it.
Yeah.
And obviously, there's a whole subplot with another Russian, the people trafficker I was talking about, gangster. His name's Alexander. And can you talk a bit about his relationship to Anton in your play?
Yes. Well, there's... in the scene where Chekhov is... Well, it looks like he's been arrested. Well, the police arrive and suspect that maybe he's trying to groom a child in the park. Yeah. But then they start suspecting maybe he's an illegal immigrant, so which I think is the other thing that's quite likely to happen
now. Yeah.
And he's rescued by this guy who's who's Russian as well and is sort of sick of Russians being treated badly. And it's, you know, it's one of those things when I was writing this play, thinking I really love the fact that a fairly serious new play has a line like, "Get down on the motherfucking ground, motherfuckers." I just thought that was so ridiculous when I wrote it. Yeah. I don't think John Osborne would ever written it. Anyway, and he basically, kind of the guise of helping Chekhov, he gets a bit of Chekhov's tiny, very sparse ID off him. Mm. And Alexander is trying to, basically, people traffics. He's got a vast number of prostitutes, one suspects. And one of his girls has gone to another pimp, basically. Mm. And he's determined to get her back because it looks bad. And he uses Chekhov's ID, which means, again, I think it's quite fun. He goes around... He rampages through this kind of underworld, claiming to be Anton Chekhov. So it's, you know, there's a scene where he tortures a guy who's tied in a chair, and he's kind of hitting him with the butt of the gun, saying, "I'm Anton Chekhov. Tell me what, tell me, you know, where this."
And
where
then,
this
of course, goes. From the other point of view, the police are seeking Anton Chekhov.
Yeah, that's right. Which creates a kind of bizarre, false, additional trail where they keep telling his niece.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I'm afraid we've discovered that your uncle has invaded a nightclub, killed the guards, tortured the owner. But of course, the end of that story, by the way, I don't want to give that away exactly, but there's another sort of Chekhovian aspect to the end of that, which is the sort of the misfiring gun of Uncle Vanya, the sort of the failed murder attempt.
But. Yeah. No, let's keep that our secret. can you talk a bit about your Anton's character? I mean, obviously, he's an imaginary creation.
Yeah.
And he's not actually
your
view of Chekhov completely, is he?
No. No, of course not. I mean, I suppose one of the things that is sort of important... Well, it was very important to me is that I kind of didn't want this to be a play... sort of theatre insiders, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
So I didn't really want it to be a play about Chekhov as such, because really it's just sort of Rip Van Winkle's story, and it could sort of be anybody.
Yeah, and he's not, your Anton isn't literary.
No.
He's not given long speeches in which he dreams of Russia or anything like that, although there's a couple of poetic moments.
Well, so sort of, in a sense, it's what he had to be was a man who's woken up after 100 years, and that's the key.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are some nice additional things. Partly, as I say, things you might associate with Chekhov in terms of this somewhat satirical gaze. Also, I think it means that the play is maybe this is just something I think, but the play is asking questions about how we represent the world now by flashing back 100 years to somebody who represented the world in a different way.
Yeah.
So it kind of there brings a kind of a clash between, I suppose, a sort of contemporary dramaturgical style
And how would you describe that, those short scenes?
Short scenes, fragmented. I mean, I think it's sort of, I hope it's not completely obvious what my moral judgments are of the characters. So that it's so things are very much presented to you without a lot of commentary.
Oh yeah, there's virtually no commentary as such. I mean, occasionally Anton looks bemused or says he doesn't understand what's going on, which is nice. It's once again, it's the emperor with no clothes, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. And so, I think Chekhov's character. Mm. I mean, he's he's almost, one of the things I kept thinking of when I was writing it, and actually we've raised in rehearsal, is Peter Sellers' character in Being There, which is film, Chance the Gardener, who's this sort of simpleton, very simple character, who has spent his entire life as a gardener, is probably not very bright, and so, but his tiny gnomic remarks about gardening are suddenly taken on by TV chat shows and so on, as if they're extraordinary Confucian wisdom. So there's something of a sort of a kind of wanderer. Also there's something slightly clownish about him. There's a bit of sort of Monsieur Hulot sort of about him. And Simon Stokes, who's directed the plays, talked as well about the kind of wandering Jew, that sort of sense of an exile as well. So there's somebody who's kind of rootless, which I think is a very interesting.
And yet you're quite detached from your own character, because of course somebody else writing the same idea might have gone into Anton's mind in the sense and saying, you know, it must be incredibly shocking and bewildering and totally upsetting to be 100 years hence and just simply not understand anything about what's going on.
Yeah, I could have gone. Well, two things about that. I think one is that I think kind of in playwriting, as in Texas, you kind of have to dance with the one that brung you. By which I mean, if your opening conceit for a play is Anton Chekhov has woken from a coma after 100 years, that's an absurd and probably, hopefully, a funny idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me, if you then try and stack a very, very serious psychological tragedy on top of it, people are going to kind of think, ah, come on, that's ridiculous. Yeah. So in a sense, the tone of it has to be somewhat comic. The other side of that, though, is there's an additional dramaturgical problem, which is because my sort of conception of Anton is essentially quite a passive person who sits in scenes watching people babble. It was quite hard to give him a sort of psychological journey. But there are a number of ways. I think this comes across quite well in performance. There is a sort of increasing despair, even in his tiny reactions to things. And then also we've given him a couple of moments where actually we do almost entirely enter his mind. So there is the true fact, well, as far as we know, that one of his, as he was dying, and he was delirious with some of the treatments he was having, he hallucinated that his wife, Olga Knipper, was floating in the northern lights talking to him. And I kind of thought, that's a great scene. So there is a moment very late in the play where, and they've done this beautifully in Plymouth, gosh, cut so beautifully. It's kind of a really 19th century transformation scene where the stage splits open and Olga talks to him from the northern lights, which is kind of gorgeous. And of course that is completely, well, is it, it's in his head, or is it, does it actually happen? I don't really know.
Looking at the play from a different angle, how much were you conscious that it was a kind of state of the nation play or state of our contemporary culture play? I mean, you've thrown in lots of things that are very typical, that are very now.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, I mean, it's not, I mean, what it, of course, isn't is a state of the state play. There's very little politics.
Yeah, I don't remember any Lib Dems being mentioned.
There are no coalition members. That would have been possibly in some sense too obvious.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. And you don't want to date your play.
In some ways, what you're absolutely, absolutely right about is, of course, there's an attempt to try and capture what our culture is like now. And, and that works on the level of language as well. I mean, I'm a lot of the work in the play is clearly about trying to capture very distinctively contemporary speech rhythms in all their weird circularity and hesitations and so on. And in my most arrogant moments, actually this probably isn't my most arrogant moment, but I would love to think that, in 20 years' time somebody could look at this play and kind of go, that sort of is how people spoke. Sort of in the last 5 years, and that even 15 years ago we didn't speak like that.
You give a few production notes in the play text for the directors and the cast and so, director and the cast. Could you talk us through some of those, for example? I mean, you say that you don't care whether men play women as long as it's not systematic. One of the characters, Marsha, is she black? why did you decide to...
Yeah, and the basic idea, I suppose, in part comes from one of the epigraphs to the play is as you mentioned the Emperor's New Clothes, and so I was interested in that sense of making Chekhov a naturalistic character, so he would look like Chekhov and he would dress like Chekhov, and we give him it's not naturalistic, but it's I had to have him learn English at some point and so on, so that those things are explained, but that everyone else is working to a different kind of theatrical logic. And it did seem to me that if you had a sort of sense that I wanted quite a bare stage, and I wanted people to not be dressed in particularly exciting or not dressed in character clothes, because one of the things that happens with almost everyone he meets is they're constantly saying, look at this place, don't you think it's amazing, this costs $3 million to do up, and of course we're just looking at a fairly bare stage. And the fashion designer kind of says, the thing I'm wearing, this is a totally contemporary fashion statement, but of course it's just a shirt and jeans that he was wearing in the previous one. In fact, in that scene, there's quite a nice joke which I'd sort of forgotten I'd put in, but the fashion designer is showing off various photos, and he has three different models come in who are all played by the same person, all wearing the same thing. And, each time he says, now this is completely different, and this is only going to hit the walks in a couple of years. And Chekhov says to him, like, it looked very like the last one, which makes me laugh, anyway. So there is that stage direction. We haven't actually done in Plymouth the arbitrary casting, because Simon Stokes, who directed it, probably quite rightly, just thought it might just be a level of bafflement that would actually just prevent an audience engaging with the meat of the scenes, because they're constantly worrying about who it is. But I'm quite interested, as you say, in the Marcia example. Marcia is the R&B star who shows Chekhov around her crib. I'm quite interested in writing a character who in some ways is quite detailed and specific, but you have no idea whether she's black or white.
And in this production, is she black?
She's white in this one.
Oh, right.
Well, the actor is white.
Yeah.
But
the character could be anything. All right, good. You call that scene 22 a kind of tear in the middle of the play. Why did you call it that?
That's the scene called It's a Totally New Concept in Light Entertainment, which is Chekhov is... somehow is talking to a pair of reality TV executives. And it's a scene which starts from describing this stupid-sounding program called Helping Hand, where they basically go in and transform someone's life. And one of the executives tries to talk about the fact that a lot of reality TV is sort of voyeurism, but this is actually trying to do something that's morally good. And she gets quite fixated on this, and it turns into this kind of quite unpunctuated, desperate despairing soliloquy, basically, about the way in which she feels she's lost any kind of moral compass. And I suppose my feeling, even though clearly the play's satirical, and it's a lot of fun is had at the expense of some of these characters, I don't actually feel that these are all despicable people. And I'm more inclined to... I think they're all quite admirable in lots of ways. So the so the internet guru, for example, as I said, you know, I think it's... This app he's created is kind of amazing. And actually that visionary way of sort of saying books are dead, music is history, you know, you make your own life now and everything's got to be interactive. There's something kind of extraordinarily imaginative about that. And I think most of the characters are... are just incredibly creative, articulate, clever people who are just terribly misdirecting their efforts into often worthless and stupid activities.
Yeah, I think that's true. There is a kind of inner tension, isn't it, between people who obviously want to help other people, and yet at the same time they get caught within a language that they've been taught or that they've learned or that they've picked up, which actually in some way diminishes what they're trying to do. It's almost as if the language is the enemy. But the only thing I worried about is that there are so few good people in the play. I just wonder, in performance, do you get that feeling that we are living in hell because there are no good people anywhere?
Well, except I suppose I think they are. They're good people, but they're just... I think the way you said it is kind of perfect. You know, they are trapped. They found themselves trapped in a language or a style that it sort of prevents them actually being in touch with the things they probably actually believe. You know what I mean? And so, you know, so even the fashion designer, who I think is the most reprehensible of them all, you know, I'm always delighted by... I love creativity with language, and I mean that in terms of the sort of weird stuff that people constantly come up with a new language, and he refers to things being kind of super fun and that sort of thing. You know, and I still think there's a kind of joyful energy even in that. So yes, I think they are basically good people.
You did a Guardian blog just before the production opened, asking the big question about the huge amount of other playwrights who have written about Chekhov, as well as obviously adapting his plays into different social settings. Can you talk us through a bit of that? Because one of the really striking phrases was Chekhov our contemporary, in the same way as Shakespeare our contemporary.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are lots of examples. I mean, there's a disproportionate number of Chekhov sequels and prequels and things like that. And then there have been lots of plays about Chekhov himself, loads of movies in particular. You can get most of his life through the movies. And then there are weird hybrids like Howard Barker's Uncle Vanya, which is sort of Uncle Vanya, except at a certain moment the characters rebel against the play, and Chekhov himself, the play splits apart, and Chekhov enters and is engaged in a battle with his characters, which is, you know, typically brilliant, mad, how Barker can see. And I suppose the question was kind of, why is that? What is it that keeps us nagging away at Chekhov? And my answer is, I suppose there is something deeply contemporary. I refer to it, and loads of people, as always, shout you down in the comment boxes about it, but I refer to a sort of pitiless gaze. And I think what I mean by that, which is not to say that he lacks pity for the characters, but he doesn't show pity in the way he represents them. Exactly. So it's sort of that sense that he doesn't kind of try and make people seem nicer than they are. And he shows you flaws and everything. The complexity of individual characters with a remarkable lack of commentary. And I think that's, compared to Ibsen, just as brilliant playwright in so many ways. But, you know, Ibsen is right there on stage with these characters, telling you what to think of them, drawing the moral, drawing the conclusion, and, you know, certainly giving an editorial standpoint. Mm. You know, Three Sisters, tons of stuff happens in Three Sisters. An amazingly plotty play, but you only ever see in action and people getting bored of stuff and, you know, passing the time while the action takes place off stage, waiting for the action to happen. And so, of course, that gives you an extraordinary space in which to let a character reveal itself sort of naturally, not very comfortable with that word, but, you know, at a sort of a reasonably slow, realistic pace, which is why, you know, sometimes the really great productions that I've seen of Chekhov plays are often the very long ones, you know. I mean, like Katie Mitchell's Three Sisters, the National, which I really loved. There was a moment of panic early in that production when I remember that somebody brought on flowers, and one of the sisters, Irina, maybe, arranges them in a vase, and you kind of think, oh, this is taking forever. And you realise, actually, it takes you a couple of minutes to arrange flowers in a vase. Yeah. But on stage, normally, they just pop them in a vase and they're all fine. Yeah. And you actually go, no, I'm going to relax. It's like slow food.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just, if this, things will take the time they need to take. And, you know, that's a wonderful experience.
Right. On that note about time,
oh, yeah?
I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.